Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from People Mover. Help update the public transit service plan. Visit transitonthemove.com to take the latest public survey by April 26th.
Hello and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your newest host, Ann Hillman. If you're a longtime listener of Alaska Public Media, you may recognize my voice. I worked in newsrooms around the state for many years, but I recently went back to school for social work. Now I'm privileged to work in behavioral health in rural Alaska. On today's show, we'll be discussing behavioral health crises with Anchorage's mobile crisis team and what they've learned about crisis response since the program began in the summer of 2021. We'll also hear about their new CORE program and how it's helping people access the resources they need. My guests today are Dr. Jennifer Pierce, who is the program manager of the Anchorage Fire Department's Integrated Health Program, and AFD's Assistant Chief, Ben Lewis. Thank you both for being here. Before we get into more details about who they are and their roles, I want to let listeners know that this is a pre-recorded show, so you won't be able to call in or email with your questions. So, Jen, tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I actually started out as a police officer with the Anchorage Police Department for many years. I then went back to school, got my master's in clinical psychology, went to work at Providence Hospital. Then went back to school, got my PhD in clinical community psychology at UAA, and that's where I started with the fire department as a student. Actually started as a student on our CORE program, when we first launched it, with a community paramedic. And then from there, the fire department was really looking at building the mobile crisis team, and I got hired on to help build the mobile crisis team and be a clinician on it. And so now I oversee the mobile crisis team and also the CORE team within our mobile integrated health program, which really looks at how do we combine not only how do we help individuals in the community where they're at, but with that medical and that mental health lens of how do we look at a person as a whole and really help them.
Great. Yeah, I definitely want to dig into that deeper. Ben, what is your role in all of this?
I am an assistant chief with the Anchorage Fire Department. I've been in this role for about 2 years. My background is I was a firefighter and a paramedic with the Anchorage Fire Department for about 13 years before I started promoting up the ranks. Right now, I oversee the EMS division, our mobile integrated health division, of which we're talking about today, as well as our dispatch center and our data systems division.
All right. That's a lot of different moving parts you've got underneath you.
Yeah.
So let's focus in on integrated health. You kind of hinted at it, like it's looking at a person as a whole person. Yeah. I don't think integrated health, let's call the fire department. Like, how did this come about?
Yeah, I think when you go back a little ways, kind of realizing, and I'll even go back to when I was a police officer, like responding to calls, responding to people in the community. Sometimes we get there and we only see like one part of it, right? We only have one side of it. And the mental health crisis or the behavioral health crisis that's happening is just kind of like, I didn't have training. I didn't understand what I was seeing as a police officer. And when I started working as a student within the Anchorage Fire Department, the paramedic who started it, Mike Riley, realized when he was working with individuals that there was a lot of times a behavioral health component along with the chronic medical. And so bringing in that mental health piece was hugely helpful in understanding a person and how to best help them in the moment. And having that integrated portion is a huge part of how we can help individuals. Because a lot of times in the mobile crisis team, we're kind of, and on the CORE team as well, we're kind of like looking at it and going, is this a medical crisis, a mental health crisis, or both? Because a lot of times medical crises can actually look like mental health crises too at the same time. So it's important to kind of tease that out and get them the right help at the right time.
I would add to it as well, the calls for service with the Anchorage Fire Department have increased about 50% in the last 10 years. And as you probably know, the population of Anchorage has not increased 50% in the last 10 years. In fact, I think it's probably flatline at best.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, so like up 50%, like what does that mean about how many calls do
you get? So we were about 10 years ago, we were about 35,000 calls for service in a year, and now we're up over 50,000 calls in 2025. Okay. We're not really running more heart attacks and strokes, those kind of typical medical emergencies you think of. So the demand of the community has changed on what they need from the fire department. So this the implementation of these new programs is our attempt to meet what the community demand is. So we didn't just make this up. This is a nationwide effort as well, but we're really trying to adapt to what the community needs are.
Okay. And I'd love to take kind of another step back and define a few things for our listeners. So first things first, like what is a mobile crisis team versus what is a core team?
Great question. A mobile crisis team is made of a licensed mental health clinician with either an EMT or a paramedic responding to crises that are happening in the moment. So someone's calling 311 or 911 and they're asking for help saying, I'm in a crisis. Our core team does follow up. So our core team gets referrals from our line, from our operations, when they say, hey, they went on a call, they saw someone who needed some extra help, or there's someone who is using emergency services kind of repeatedly because their needs aren't being met at the hospital. There's something that's just missing in there. And so the core team really focuses on that part, like the follow-up piece and trying to connect people. Core team also is doing a little something different with opioid responses. So the core team also helps responding to individuals after they've overdosed or having withdrawal symptoms and providing with sublingual buprenorphine, which is Suboxone, in the field, in the community, and getting them connected to long-term MOUD treatment. The MOUD. Medication of opioid use disorder.
Okay. Yeah. And what does CORE stand for?
Community Outreach, Referral, and Education.
Okay. So we keep talking about a crisis. Someone's in a crisis. What exactly does it mean to be in a crisis? I feel like that word can mean so many different things to so many different people.
That's the beauty of how broad that definition is. A crisis can be very different depending upon the person. And so it's not for us, it's not for me to define what a crisis is. It's for that individual. So the individual can define that their own crisis is. For us on the mobile crisis team, it could be responding to someone who's struggling with anxiety, with a panic attack, someone who's maybe feeling suicidal or feeling really down, or someone who maybe is all of a sudden struggling with a psychosis, like they're hearing and seeing things that other people are not. Sometimes we get calls where people are really struggling at home and they just don't know like what to do for the next steps in their life because they've reached an age where maybe they have some cognitive decline and they just don't know what to do next. Mm-hmm. And so they feel like they're overwhelmed by that decision making. Behavioral crisis is also really broad because that also includes substance use. Right. So if someone is struggling with substance use and they really want to get treatment, you know, they can call and we can help them navigate that system because it is a hard system to navigate. And so we're there to help support that as well.
Okay. And Ben, would you like to add?
Oh, I was just going to say this isn't that may sound like a pretty narrow scope, but this now represents about 12% of all of our calls. So almost like 1 in 8 of our calls relates to what Jen just described as most appropriate for the mobile crisis team to respond to. And again, as we've progressed as a system, 10 years ago when I was a paramedic on the street and we would run these same calls, our options were very limited. Like mm-hmm. we had no special training on how to deal with a behavioral crisis. We would take them to the emergency room, which was our only option at the time. And if you've been to the emergency room, they're not really necessarily the best stabilizing environment for people in a behavioral health crisis. And then, I don't work at the hospital, but, they end up having one-on-one, you know, assigned care, which takes away from other resources and really a lot of times not good outcomes for those folks in that ED environment as well. The mobile crisis team averages, 85% that stay safely in the community when the team responds. The other 15% are appropriately need to go for more longer-term supervised care.
Wow, so that's reducing a lot of people going to emergency.
A lot. The mobile crisis team is the busiest apparatus in the Anchorage Fire Department. So that includes all the ambulances, it includes all the fire engines, the mobile crisis team, unit, and it wasn't even in service 24/7 last year, it will be this year, is still runs the most calls of all our other apparatus.
Wow. So when you're getting that number of calls, how do you train the dispatchers to deal with that and to identify that they should be calling mobile crisis team versus calling a paramedic versus calling a fire truck?
I'll start and you can layer in. The way our dispatch center works is when someone calls 911, the dispatchers triage it into categories. And within those categories, there are response plans and basically determinant codes that they land on. Those point to specific response plans that are approved by our medical director. So the dispatcher, through that triage process and asking the right questions, can sort of be guided to that this is most appropriate for a mental health clinician to respond to. As far as the training part, I'll let Jen speak to that. I think we were a little behind on this, and Jen's been working really hard to play catch up.
That's pretty honest. Before we jump over to Jen and the training, I guess if I were a community member and I called 911 and I was in a behavioral health crisis, like what kind of questions would the dispatchers be asking me? Like what should I personally expect if I'm going through this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, I think something that is really important for a community to know is that that when you first call 911 or 311, option one, the phone call goes through Anchorage Police Department first.
Okay.
So you're gonna have a dispatcher through Anchorage Police first will get the call, and then they'll send it over to fire dispatch. And so the questions that they're going to be asking a lot of times are, where's the location of the emergency? Because we need to know where you are.
Logical, yeah.
And then tell me what's going on. You know, like, tell me what's happening. And then they're going to ask, like, some safety questions of, is there anyone who's violent on scene? Is there any weapons on scene? Is there a crime that's occurring? Because those are things that we won't respond to first.
Okay.
So if there's someone who's violent on scene, if there's physical aggression or a weapon or a crime currently occurring, that's going to go to a higher level of care.
What if it's physical aggression, like a kid being physically aggressive?
Yeah. So then our dispatchers will ask more questions of like, are they going to be physically aggressive towards our responders? And a lot of times the answer is no, right? A lot of times the kids are going to be a little more responsive. Sometimes they'll start with, okay, we'll have our mobile crisis team call you first. And sometimes we'll vet the call a little bit more and talk to the person, maybe even talk to the kid on the phone to make sure it's safe for us to respond, because that's our number one priority.
All right. So the call, we talk to police. Mm-hmm. Is there an alternative if people, like, I would guess that some people are like, no, I don't want to go through police dispatch. Like, can you circumvent that process and go straight to mobile crisis? Nope.
No. Okay. Yeah, this is how our system always works. A lot of times people call in, will specifically ask for the mobile crisis team. And I know our police department is pretty good at pushing those calls straight over.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So people can request.
Yeah.
All right. So dispatcher gets a little bit more information. Like let's talk about the kind of the dispatcher training.
So it's something we're definitely working on evolving. You know, it started out when we very first started mobile crisis team. I sat down with every single dispatcher at the fire department, and we did some training about this is what we do, and these are the calls that we're going to. And it started out with us maybe getting one or two calls a day, just because the dispatchers were a little unsure, and I think the system was a little unsure who we were, what we're doing. So it took a lot of communicating with the dispatchers, like, that was a great call you sent us on, or that was not a good call. So communicating back and forth, and I try to touch base with our dispatchers as often as possible still to this day, of kind of talking about the calls that come in and how we're dispatched to them. And now moving forward, I'm working on applying for a grant to hopefully get all of our dispatchers some additional training as well. So getting them that CIT training.
What's CIT?
CIT training is called crisis intervention training, which has been, you know, throughout law enforcement. But this training is specifically just for dispatchers and how to talk on the phone with someone, that very brief touch. How do you talk to someone in a behavioral health crisis and also identify when they're having a behavioral health crisis versus something else happening?
I think there's also a cultural learning curve for our dispatch center as well. In the beginning, I know that they were very apprehensive for people that they are recognizing or experiencing a behavioral health crisis, and just the perception of danger for the responders. So they would very often defer things back to the police department just for that, like, you know, extra safety factor. And after, you know, a couple years now of like seeing like that these clinicians are professionals, we have firefighters on with them as well that have very good operational situational awareness. And we've had really great success in maintaining a very safe posture for the responders and for the clients that they're serving. And that has reinforced the dispatch centers and the dispatchers there to feel more comfortable sending things to the team.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, this is Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Joining me today are Jen Pierce and Ben Lewis from the Anchorage Fire Department for a conversation about Anchorage's crisis response team. So dispatchers get the call. They call mobile crisis team. What does mobile crisis team do?
Great question. So mobile crisis team will start by kind of reading the call. And sometimes we get a lot of notes. Sometimes it's John Doe phone number. And so we don't get very many notes. So
like you get like a computer screen or something?
Yeah. We get a computer dispatch and then we get some notes from dispatch actually types in. We call it our CAD. And we can look at like the notes that maybe the person said. And sometimes we get like a lot more notes. Sometimes, like I said, it's just a name and a phone number and an address, and that's all we get. So then we start by almost always reaching out to the person via phone and just saying, you know, I'm Jen, I'm with the Anchorage Fire Department Mobile Crisis Team. Tell me what's going on today. And we just start there. Usually from that phone call, then we're going to respond in person, you know, and see where that person's at, see how we can help them and meet them where they're at for that moment.
I think one thing to add to that, one of the things that the Anchorage Fire Department is unique in is the way that beginning, where the team is housed and how that dispatch comes in. So the mobile crisis team is actually housed in a fire station. So they respond out of the fire station right alongside the fire engine and the ambulance and the fire ladder trucks. And that's pretty unique in the nation to have that model. And it's worked very, very well for us.
Why? Like, why have that model?
Because they're an integral part of our system now. Like there's no, like we're well beyond considering this a pilot. Like this is, I mean, it's in city ordinance now that the Anchorage Fire Department have a mobile crisis team. Like this is a necessary, thing that everyone, regardless, I think of your political views, agrees that this is a necessary, response mode to have in the fire department. And the way we operate is we respond our people out of fire stations. And so we integrated the mobile crisis team into a fire station about a year and a half ago. And there was some like reluctance, some cultural reluctance, because these are mental health clinicians. Are they going to be trying to psychoanalyze people at the kitchen table at night? But we work through all that, and now they're embraced. They wear the same uniforms as the firefighters, and it's gone amazing.
And did you have to do special training with the paramedics and the EMS folk who respond alongside the clinicians?
Ooh. So we started in the academy, actually. So in the academy, we've done it. This will be our fourth year. We've done four years in a row now where we do mental health first aid for EMS. It's myself that teaches it. And then the paramedic I started this all with, Mike Riley. So we teach it together. And then we do another class that's very separate within the academy that is verbal de-escalation and trauma-informed care for all of them. And then when we very, very first launched MCT, we actually did do the entire fire department got trained in verbal de-escalation, trauma-informed care, and mobile crisis team. From there, what we have found is being fully integrated in the fire department and the way we work is that the firefighters, I love getting those phone calls of, hey, Jen, I saw you do this on a call once. I don't really understand it, but it was this weird grounding thing you did with someone. And I did it, and it worked. Like, it was great. We didn't have to take the person to the hospital. And so it's always great to hear that it's a lot of that modeling too. Like, we do the training. We're working on it. Like, I keep wanting to give more and more training and offer it to the fire department, to the line. And we're not perfect by any means. At the same time, I think modeling has been huge, of people seeing how we interact with people, the things that we say, the things that we do, and just hearing and seeing other people use that and seeing it work has been, I think, a really good learning point for the whole line.
And the exposure to the line, the staffing model we use is actually an overtime model right now. So an overtime person works with the clinician, and it's irrespective of rank. So from a firefighter EMT to a engineer, which are the people who drive the fire trucks, to a captain, to a senior captain, all work it. And what that has done is allow this department-wide exposure to these techniques, to how to deal with people in behavioral health crisis before a clinician gets there. It's been really great. I think we're in the process of progressing past that, but it has been a really great model for us for the last couple years.
On the flip side, hiring the clinicians has been an important part for us of making sure we're hiring the right clinician for the job.
I would definitely love to talk to you more a little bit about that right after we take our first break. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media, and we will be right back. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Joining me today are Jen Pierce and Ben Lewis from the Anchorage Fire Department for a conversation about Anchorage's crisis response team. Just a reminder, this is a pre-recorded show, so we're not accepting any calls or emails. So you guys, you just before the break brought up, like, it takes a lot to hire a clinician for this kind of role. Tell me more.
Yeah. So one thing that we did when we're building this program is we spent time reaching out to all sorts of mobile crisis teams across the nation and actually in Canada, and learning how did they hire people, what was their process like, what did they learn, what went well, what didn't go well. And we took all that information back and made sure that we were building a team that was best for this community, right? So as we're building this program, we've learned, I think, different ways of interviewing. And something that I did learn from someone else is about offering a ride-along, actually, to people who are interviewing. And so we do two rounds of interviews. And the first round is really focused on that clinical lens of, like, you know, tell me about your experiences. Because to be a crisis clinician, you got to be a Swiss Army knife. I mean, we respond to all ages, any type of mental health history or behavioral health history. And so you got to be good at working with children, adults, and geriatric patients. And so sometimes I get these questions like, oh, you only work with the, like, adult population. I'm like, no, like, I've worked with a four-year-old, like, in the community. And I've worked with someone, we were just talking this morning about, we were working with this individual who's 92 years old, and we're working with him right now. And so you have to be flexible, you have to think on your feet, and you have to love that you don't know what's going to happen every day. if those are things that you enjoy doing and being out in the community, you know, this is definitely the job for you. Sitting behind a desk is really boring for me.
I hear you.
It's hard. So that's the first, you know, we're looking at those clinical skills, and then we offer a ride along for them to experience what is a day like. And then the next interview we really look at, is this person going to be a good fit for the fire department? Do they have that problem solving? Are they flexible? Are they, you know, someone who is up for, you know, every day is going to be different? You know, those are really important key factors in it. And I think, you know, we've had a really good retention rate with our clinicians. They really enjoy it. And I think also, when we're building this program from the beginning, we really thought about resiliency for the clinician. That was something that we put forward as, like, this is going to be a really important part to prevent that burnout from happening, especially with such a unique job. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we're looking at hiring, we're really focusing on that too, of how can we hire someone where we know that we can help increase their resilience and that they're going to be a good fit.
You know, like, when earlier before the break, when you were talking about how the paramedics are seeing you do grounding techniques with folks out in the field and probably doing a lot of deep breathing, and, you know, the different stuff that that helps you regulate your system, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So how much of, like, do you have your clinicians, like, teaching those skills internally so everyone's building resilience to deal with this kind of constant mm-hmm. churn of change?
Yeah, I have a really big boundary with that, actually. So our clinicians are for the community.
Yeah.
Right? Our clinicians don't really work specifically with the firefighters. Mm-hmm. Because I just want that to be very specific of, like, you're part of the family when you're at mm-hmm. the Anchorage Fire Department. And so I just didn't want those lines to be blurred. Now that's something that I'm slowly starting to offer. Like, we had the Alzheimer's Association come in and offer training to our fire department. I'm bringing in someone from the Opioid Response Network on a grant. So she's going to come in and do a training on motivational interviewing.
Cool.
Yeah.
And what is that?
Motivational interviewing. It's an intervention where we really work at how do we help incite change within a person without telling them to stop it.
Yep.
Stop it doesn't work. But how do I guide someone through making a positive change in their life, or how do I help support them in a way of figuring out what's going on? My best example for this is we're working with an individual who needed to go to the hospital. He had really bad leg infections and was going down a really bad path, and he kept saying no to the hospital. And our operations kept trying and trying with him, and he just kept saying no. And so we went there. We used some motivational interviewing. We were curious, like, how come you don't want to go to the hospital? Like, what are your concerns? What are your worries? Mm-hmm. And he was able to tell us his concerns and worries and what they were, and we were able to solve those and overcome them. And he got to the hospital, and he had a really good outcome. A year later, I saw him, and he goes, "Hey, thanks for getting me to the hospital. You saved my life."
Nice.
It's like, oh man.
It's good. Positive feedback there.
Yeah. And so those, I'm really excited to get that training in. And it's mm-hmm. offered to our line. It's optional. It's voluntary training that they can come and do. But I think the more we can also bring outside people into the fire department, I think people can only listen to me so much. You know, it brings in those different opportunities and for people to learn more about what the fire department does as well mm-hmm. as we bring outside people in to train.
Okay. Because it seems like let's move on to talking about the core team a little bit, because it seems like this is sort of a natural shift. Like, core team really is about integrating community resources all together and getting them to work together a little bit more for people who are struggling. So can you tell us a little bit about core? Like, it was here, it was gone.
Yeah.
It's what's the history there and the need?
I think I'll just intro it for you, but I think this is, once again, like, when we look at what are the needs of the community. So this was, we see gaps still on things that we're not able to provide through either the mobile crisis team or through traditional, like, EMS response. And for us, that was high utilizers of the system. They're sort of stuck in the cycle of, like, into the ED. And sometimes these folks are released from the emergency room before the ambulance providers are even done with their report and they're seeing them. And then there's times when we run on them 3-4 times in a 24-hour shift. And there's no good, like, way right now. There's no follow-up. Like, there's no capacity in EMS right now to, like, perform that duty. Vulnerable adults, like, we know there's, you know, the state has services, of course, but there's times just on a more micro scale where just having someone follow up with a vulnerable adult would be tremendously beneficial, and just connecting them to a more appropriate resource for them. Go ahead.
What do you mean? Like, vulnerable adult? I feel like that's another pretty broad term.
I can give a great example. So Jen's brought up Mike Riley a couple times, his name. He was part of the initial pilot program years ago for the CORE program. I was a paramedic in South Anchorage, and we would run on this individual who had limited mobility. But we would run on him.
Run meaning?
We would respond to him. Like 911 would be called on his behalf. And usually it was him hitting his life alert button, say, "I need help." He was, he had limited mobility in his legs. He had a lot of, like, just health conditions that were really not well managed for him. And we'd run on him, respond to him 2 or 3 times in a 24-hour period. And everyone was doing this. And we'd take him to the emergency department. He'd get released. He'd go back home. Well, Mike came in and actually co-responded with them to this. And I watched him connect this person to a physician to get like better care, and then to an assisted living home, which actually could provide an appropriate level of assistance that he needed. It sounds bad. I thought he passed away because we stopped running on him. And then one day, like, we ran on someone else in the assisted living home, and I saw him in the other room, and I went in and said hi, and I'm like, I thought you died, like, and here you are. And he's like, yeah, I'm doing great. Like, this place is awesome. This is exactly what I needed. But it took someone with the perspective from that we have from EMS to see the needs he had in his house. And it didn't really qualify to the level of like state protective services, because he wasn't living in like terrible conditions or anything. He just needed like an extra, like, you know, push to get to the right place.
And is that often the case with when you guys keep saying high utilizers? So I'm assuming that means people who call 911 over and over and over and not necessarily for something that's actually an emergency. But so, like, is this often the case with folks who call over and over and over? They just have their basic health needs and or mental health needs just aren't being met.
That subjective definition of crisis, right?
Yeah, it is. It's usually when I go out and meet people for the first time and I outreach them, I do talk to them about, you know, we've noticed that you've been going to the emergency room a lot. And I'm guessing that there's something that's missing. There's some needs that are just not being met. And so I want to understand what is happening so we can help you and get those needs met. And through that, you know, it's doing a you know, asking them questions and meeting them where they're at and really digging into, you know, not only what are your medical concerns, do you have any food insecurities? How is your housing? How is your mental health? Like, how is your mood? Like, how is that impacting you? And, you know, are you having any struggling with any substance use? Just recently with our opioid response, you know, we actually had a referral for someone who was using the emergency room. And then through that, we were able to identify, like, oh, this is also someone who wants help and like wants more treatment. And so we were able to combine like all these different appointments for that individual and help them get to their first appointment to make sure there is that connection. Because sometimes in Anchorage, transportation is a huge barrier, or waiting on hold. I kind of joke with people like, I'll wait on hold for you for over a half hour at the doctor's office. For myself, no, I won't do it.
But for you,
like, it's easier for someone else to do it sometimes, to sit on the hold and to navigate those systems, because they are hard. They are hard to navigate sometimes.
Why is the fire department doing this? This sounds like that sounds like the role of like a case manager at a behavioral health service. But you guys are the fire department.
So when I see myself in CORE is I'm going to get them connected to that behavioral health or that case manager, and then I'm going to step away.
Okay.
That's always my goal, is a lot of times there's these barriers or things that prevent people from getting connected to the right resource. And so our goal is to help get them that connection, get them on that road, and then we'll step away from it and let them take over. Because there's usually some advocacy piece that's missing.
Yeah.
And so we're there to advocate for them, to give them education, and to support them to make those connections.
And sorry, I was gonna say why the fire department, you know, 50, 60 years ago, the fire department put out fires. And then at some point, the community started to demand, like, we also need you to respond to medical emergencies because there's not really anyone else to do that in a consistent way. So fire departments started responding to medical emergencies. And I do feel, and our leadership, including the fire chief, feels like this is just like a progression. Like, now the community is sort of has different expectations, and our mission statement is to serve the community before, during, and after an emergency, and we feel like this is part of that.
That makes a lot of logical sense.
We think so.
To me, but I'm a social worker, so what do you do? So, like, how long do you normally maintain, the CORE team, how long are you maintaining relationships with people?
Everyone's different. Mm-hmm. Everyone is very different.
That's the running theme.
Yes. Yeah. It's definitely meeting people where they're at or what they need. Some people, it can literally just be one touch. Like, we can connect with them one time, and then that's all that they need. They just need that little bit of help or that education. There's some people that, you know, we'll probably be working them for a little bit longer. right? Because they just need that extra help or that extra connection to get them connected, and that's okay. It just really depends on that person's need.
Do you run into any barriers within the community in terms of the resources that the people need just not being available?
Yeah. I think a lot of times the biggest barriers that we see right now is transportation, getting to places. Another barrier is, I think, with psychiatric medications. Getting in to get psychiatric medications can take a little bit. I think sometimes getting into treatment, because when people want, especially if it's substance treatment, when they want it now. And a lot of times it's like, I call a place, okay, next week at, you know, a certain time. And on mobile crisis team, that's hard because we're not able to do that follow-up as much as CORE can. So now CORE can really help with that follow-up of like, okay, your appointment's in a week. Great. We're going to touch base with you and make sure you get to that appointment. Versus MCT, we're so busy responding to crisis calls, we're not able to do that consistent follow-up all the time. So that's what makes it a little bit harder versus like MCT versus CORE with our barriers in our community. I have to say, though, when I first started on mobile crisis team, it would take about 2 weeks to get someone into detox. Now I've been able to get someone into detox within an hour of me calling, or the most I've had to wait is probably 3 days now. So I'm really excited to see those changes in our community, like, and see them live happening. So I'm really hopeful for more access in the future. And I know like South Central Foundation and Providence are working on the stabilization centers and some other things up and coming. So I'm just really excited to see that our access to treatment is getting better and better and better.
Yeah, it probably makes it a lot. It gives more hope to clinicians and and community members alike.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You all kind of touched on earlier in the program that there's this new opioid buprenorphine response. And you're giving people Suboxone right at the moment. Can you talk a little bit about how that developed and why it's a crucial service for this community?
Do you want to start with the...
Yeah, start with the broad and the numbers.
Start with the broad. Yeah, I think once again, this is just an example of an unmet need. So I keep comparing things to what they were 10 years ago, because that's sort of the track that makes sense. But 10 years ago, responding to an overdose looked very different. There wasn't a lot of community Narcan. Like when we showed up, someone would be passed out. They would be either not breathing or barely breathing. A lot of those did not have good outcomes. So we would provide Narcan. If it was short enough in time to when they stopped breathing, like we would sort of, they like rise from the dead, you know, is what it looks like in real life. But, and all, we even had a protocol at the time, like all of those people always go to the emergency department. And at the time, there's still like capacity at the emergency department to receive these folks. Again, most of the time they would turn around and leave and be back in the community, and we'd see them again in another, you know, couple of days or week. Fast forward 10 years, I would say, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think it's like probably 50% of the time when we show up, the public, someone from the public or the community has already administered Narcan to the person, which is great because it's saving lives. But when we show up now, we take almost none of them to the emergency department because they don't want to go. And that puts us in a really bad spot. We consider them very high risk because now they've been given Narcan, they're going through withdrawals, they don't feel good.
So high risk for what?
High risk for re-overdosing. Okay. So they're going to go try to get rid of like this not great feeling that they feel because they've been put like immediately into withdrawals. So put our paramedics and EMTs responding to these like in a really bad position. Like we want to do something for these folks, but there's nothing. We have nothing to offer. They don't want to go to the ED because they're still dealing with the, you know, the big bill that they had from their last visit, which wasn't very fruitful for them. This program just felt like this is an unmet need. Like this is something now that we can offer them, and enter. Go ahead.
Enter Jen.
Yeah. And we didn't make this program without doing research. We did a lot of research. There's other fire departments in the Lower 48 that are already doing this program or a type of version of it. And so I got to go down and travel and see how the San Antonio Fire Department's doing it and how the Seattle Fire Department's doing it in real time as well, along with our research. And our medical director is very involved in like researching and talking to the other medical directors that are also doing this in fire departments. And so what we decided is we kind of combined San Antonio and Seattle, their versions, because we have a smaller population than both those cities as well. And so what San Antonio did is they did outreach or follow up with people after an overdose. So we can see, you know, when someone's been there's been a response for an opioid overdose. And so we try to outreach them and say, hey, like I saw that there was, you know, you call 911. There was an emergency that happened. How are you doing? How can we support you? Like, do you need anything? Also, we're responding with, like Seattle does, we're responding with our EMS crews when we're available, because we're a small pilot program. So we're responding to them when we're available real time to anyone who's experiencing those withdrawal symptoms or has just experienced an overdose and then was provided that Narcan, and to offer them that Suboxone in that moment. So we're taking both kind of angles at it, especially because we're not available 24/7. Mm-hmm. We're only available Tuesday through Friday right now as a small team. So.
Okay. And this is like 3 or 4 times a day we run on these types of calls.
Wow, that's a pretty high number.
Yeah. It's like I think 1 in 25 of our transports are associated with an opiate-related root cause.
All right. I'd love to hear more about that after we take another quick break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Ann Hillman, and today we're talking about Anchorage's mobile crisis team and its new core team. Our guests today are Jen Pierce and Ben Lewis with the fire department. Again, a reminder that we are pre-recorded today, so we're not taking any calls or emails. So you're getting a significant number of calls dealing with opioids right now still. Has that shifted over the years or...
It has. One data point that we do track, and this is, we've not historically done a good job on tracking this information. In the beginning of 2025, we actually added a required selection box in our reporting that everyone has to do after we run on a patient, whether someone had been given Narcan by us or by someone in the public. Or if the perception of the responder was that the situation was related to an opioid problem. And that's a required box to fill out now. So we get more accurate data starting in 2025. Before that was, I mean, we always had to put in if we gave Narcan, but we never like added in if, you know, the public did or if it was an elective thing. So we give Narcan compared to like 2018, which I think is the most accurate data I could find, about a third more today in 2025 than we did like in 2018.
Okay.
And that's considering, again, this this reality of about 50% of the time the public gives it before we do. And in 2018, that was not the case. That was, I would say, I don't remember hardly ever that happening. It's a growing problem. It's a little hard to track because there's times when you will get called for a seizure call because that's what the dispatcher has triaged the call to be. And that may indeed be the problem, but that seizure call is actually related to this opioid problem. And it wasn't a seizure. It was actually some sort of reaction that someone's having, or it could be a chest pain call because if someone's going through this, they have chest pain. And when we get there, we're like, well, this is actually related to something different that's not an acute coronary syndrome. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. Like some of the symptoms overlap and you can't always know through a phone call.
Yeah, and so that's why we added in, like, do you think that this chest pain call, for example, that traditionally would kind of fall through the cracks in our statistics would mm-hmm. not be recognized as an opiate-related problem? Now we can try to capture that. But that's pretty new for us. We don't have any historical track.
Okay. So with the CORE program, are you, I know it's fairly new at this point, but like, are people willing to go and seek longer term treatment?
Yeah, we just actually started March 1st being able to provide Suboxone in the community. So we're very new.
And for people listening, we're recording on March 31st. Yeah. So 30 days in of supplying Suboxone.
30 days in. And we've had three successful administrations. And we've had two individuals already get connected to long-term care. I'm pretty excited by that. Seattle Fire Department mentioned they had provided Suboxone in the community over a year 111 times. And so if we're kind of looking at the numbers, like I feel really positive about where we're headed. And I think it's just up from here.
Okay.
And especially as more people understand like what we're doing in the community and how the Suboxone can help them in the moment. It's so awesome to see someone like really struggling, be there in the moment for them, provide them that medication, and then they're feeling so much better mm-hmm. within like 10 to 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, okay, I'm ready for the next step.
And so are you just giving like one dose or and that's it?
So it just depends on the individual. So when we meet them where they're at, we'll provide them with the amount of Suboxone that's needed for them in that moment. And then we'll follow up with them. And if they can't get in to see a provider that next morning, we'll follow up and we can provide them with another dose if they're in withdrawals or even like the next day. We do have some connections. We're working actually really closely with the health department right now, the Anchorage Health Department, to be able to bridge people. We had this great example of where we saw someone on Friday morning. We were able to provide him with some Suboxone. And then I connected him with a provider over the Anchorage Health Department who helped bridge him with medications just through the weekend. So then we checked in with them and he got connected to that long-term care. And so what I'm really excited about is how we're all working together within our departments within Anchorage, which has been, I think, hugely successful. And we're constantly looking at how do we continue to grow this and work together mm-hmm. within Anchorage.
So I remember 10 years ago when I first started reporting on things like Suboxone, it was so controversial and people were like, oh, no, that could cause more problems than it solves. Is that controversy still there?
I think that stigma is really decreasing.
Nice.
Right. I really believe I see it decreasing. And what's really interesting about the Suboxone is a paramedic can provide it in the state of Alaska and soon even an EMT-2 level. We'll be able to provide
that's
it,
a
hopefully.
Rumor.
That's a rumor. That's a rumor going around. But that's super exciting, right? And in Seattle, they actually have EMTs providing it with medical direction oversight. Mm-hmm. And I think as that stigma decreases and as we find it to be a really safe medication to help people in the moment, I just hope more fire departments or more communities in Alaska are willing to provide that medication.
And within the fire department, is there any resistance?
No, there really isn't. I would say, though, to your stigma comment, like comparing it to 10 years ago, I would say even a year or two ago, that still kind of existed. And Jen and I had talked about this, and I think we were still like, you know, like, I don't know if this will be accepted in our mm-hmm. department. The core program within our reporting system, when our, like I mentioned, when our paramedics and EMTs are on somebody, they write a report. Jen built in the reporting system a referral connection that her and the community paramedic she works with, Josh, get a notification that the person that the EMT or paramedic ran on is appropriate for the core team in whatever, you know, whatever category is most appropriate. I thought that this core program would be successful. I mean, I knew it would be, but I was amazed when she reported to me a few weeks ago, like how many referrals that the core team had. And I mean, the core team's only been we started the pilot at the beginning of this year on January 1st. And have you looked recently?
107 referrals.
107 referrals in 3 months. So there's like enormous buy-in from the firefighters in the department. Mm-hmm. Like this is embraced. Everyone sees the need. I have a hard time imagining us without it. Already.
Pretty fast integration. Do you feel like the community is responding in the same way? Do you get any pushback?
I haven't had any pushback. In fact, when I went into a primary care appointment with someone and I was sitting in the office with them. And sometimes people just need that little bit of advocacy, that little bit of help. And so I'm sitting there quietly in the office because I'm letting her like do most of the talking. And then they kind of look at me like, the fire department, why? What are you doing here? And I was like, well, we're here to help support her. Like, we're here because, you know, she was calling, you know, called 911, wanted help, and she needed help getting to this doctor's appointment and kind of needs a little more help, advocacy and some support. And they're like, oh, this is amazing. The fire department's here. So it's been really positive. And also, we can help kind of bridge that gap and let providers know what's really going on in the home as well. Because sometimes people have a hard time maybe saying what's happening or what they need or don't need, especially when it comes to medications. Like, maybe some people will say, yeah, I'm taking my medications. And then we can look like, actually, you have a hard time remembering to take your medications. So we can advocate for them that way. We can kind of look in the home. Sometimes we can help provide providers with a bigger lens of understanding of what's happening so they know how best to help that individual. And so it's been nothing but positivity, especially with us talking to providers, because we're helping them as well, because we can be their eyes on and help support them in between those appointments.
Mm-hmm. Because you'll see things that people don't necessarily see themselves.
Absolutely.
How much time do you get to spend in folks' home with them? Like, you mentioned not like being like, I don't know so much about you taking your medications. Like, how do you see those details? How much time do you get?
What's really great about CORE is we just do follow-up and outreach for the most part, or we'll watch the calls for the opioid overdoses or withdrawal symptoms, but we can take our time. So sometimes it is an hour spending with someone kind of walking through what's going on. Or sometimes maybe it's only, you know, a 15-minute check-in or 30 minutes. With MCT, we kind of get that pressure because our calls are getting stacked. You know, we have so many behavioral health crises that we have to respond to. And so I think there's a little bit more of a pressure on MCT. Okay, I have to get to the next crisis. On CORE, though, we can really slow it down and really meet someone where they're at and kind of spend that time looking through it. The other day, I think we spent 45 minutes just trying to organize someone's medications. They had so many medications, and it was all medical, and it was hard. It was hard for us to organize it and to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so we realized this is a problem. So we were able to go and advocate at the primary care office, like, this is a problem. Like, we need to really look at these medications and really help this individual figure out how to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important distinction and a really insightful question, because that is the difference between what CORE is able to offer and MCT or a traditional EMS response. When there's an EMS response or an MCT, that's that one resource out of service. And for both both MCT and EMS, like, our push is like, turn it over, like, figure it out, get mm-hmm. into the hospital, like, get back in service. Like, we only have so many ambulances. We only have so many fire engines. We only have so many mobile crisis team units, which is one, and sometimes two. But and the difference is that CORE is able to spend that time to actually like find like a more appropriate solution, whereas the other teams don't have that. They're not afforded that opportunity in the same way.
So how do people access CORE?
So CORE right now is just a referral program through our EMS system. We're a powerful team of one. And, you know, so we're not freely accessed through the community. I will say for, you know, the opioid response, we are getting out there more and more. Providers know about us, doing a lot of stakeholder relationship building and them being able to identify there's a withdrawal symptoms so they can contact us. But being so small, it's really hard for us to take on outside referrals at this time.
You mentioned earlier that you were writing grants. So, yeah. And I know CORE was here and then it was gone. So, like, how are you funded?
Great question. So right now, we're funded through we have an MIH state grant, so Mobile Integrated Health state grant, that's helping fund CORE in this moment, which is super helpful. And it's something that we're kind of looking at. How do we stay funded, you know, next year? And it's something that we're constantly trying to figure out. How do we keep going?
So you're only funded for a year again?
Right now we are, the grant goes through the state's fiscal cycle. Mm-hmm. So end of June, but we have an additional grant opportunity that we are very confident in that'll take us through the rest of this year and potentially years beyond.
Okay. Does that add to the challenges of filling the positions? Because you don't know how long the positions exist?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and there's like some logistical challenges too. Like the city doesn't really create new positions that are grant funded necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it does, I mean, you're exactly right. It does create challenges, but also affords the opportunity to kind of vet out a program and honestly get our department and then the city and the community sort of invested in this thing that they're like, yeah, there is value to this. This is what we need in the city and the community. And that's what we're hoping by the end of this sort of grant cycle to have. And then we can pose the question to the city, like, is this something that we want to be, you know, part of our operational budget?
That makes sense.
And who knows, maybe in a few years we'll be back here talking about how we have multiple core teams that can take referrals from the community and from the emergency rooms.
Yes, yes.
But right now, being so small, you know, we're just really just trying to grow it and keep it.
All right. We have about a minute left. Any final thoughts and things that you think folks should know?
I was just going to say, I'm always so excited coming to work for the fire department. And I think that there's a lot of innovation that we're really looking at of how do we meet the needs of the community and how do we be innovative and do things a little bit differently. And I love that.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. I think as the fire department continues to be innovative and progress, I see a lot of that progression coming in this mobile integrated health realm, which will be a little atraditional from what a typical fire and EMS response has been. And I think that it will continue, hopefully, to serve the needs of this community appropriately.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being here. Today's guests were Dr. Jennifer Pierce and Assistant Chief Ben Lewis with the Anchorage Fire Department and part of their integrated health team. Just a reminder for some of the community resources that are available to you. If you are in a mental health crisis, you can always call 988. If you want to be connected to substance use or mental health resources, you can dial 211. Or to reach the fire department and the mobile crisis team in Anchorage, you can call 311, option 1, or 911. Thank you so much to our audio engineer, Tobin Shelby, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find out more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Tell us your thoughts or suggestions by emailing line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Thanks for listening.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.